Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few months, a national focus on rape and sexual violence on college campuses has exploded, thanks in large part to student and alumni activism. When one of today's guests, Annie Clark, was assaulted at the University of North Carolina, she says the school mishandled her case. So she and a friend filed a Title IX complaint against the school. Dozens of women across the country followed their lead, and the story exploded. President Obama has since established a task force to study the issue. Because more people are speaking out, more people are reporting. According to an NPR investigative analysis, the number of rapes that get reported at four-year colleges increased 49% between 2008 and 2012. Nearly one in five women and one in 16 men is the victim of an attempted or completed rape while in college. This is according to a 2000 study commissioned by the National Institute of Justice. Only between 8% and 37% of rapes ever lead to prosecution, according to research funded by the DOJ, and just 3% to 18% of sexual assaults lead to convictions. So on today's Your Call, we are talking to people who've experienced sexual assaults on their campuses, what they've been doing to speak out, and how universities have responded. How are colleges dealing with this? What are they required to do by law? And what needs to change? Today, we're joined by Annie Clark, a women's rights and civil rights activist and blogger for the Huffington Post. She is one of five complainants who filed two federal complaints against the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They are accusing the school of mishandling rape cases and violating federal law. Annie has helped form a network of students and staff at higher education institutions across the country aimed at preventing assault and holding schools accountable. Every case she has assisted in filing, over a dozen so far, is currently under investigation by the Department of Education. Annie is co-founder of the nonprofit consulting firm End Rape on Campus. In 2013, she was listed alongside President Obama as one of the most influential people in United States higher education. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are also joined by Leah Sharon Francis, a senior at Stanford majoring in English creative writing. On January 1st of this year, Leah says she was sexually assaulted through use of force by another Stanford student. She reported the rape to the police and to Stanford's Judicial Affairs Office. She had never planned to remain silent about her experience, but said Stanford began re-victimizing her, mishandling her case and violating her civil rights. So she decided to go public with her story and speak out against sexual violence at Stanford and elsewhere. And Leah will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. We also reached out to Stanford. They declined our request for an interview, but they did send us a statement, and I will read that throughout the show. So Annie, I want to start off with you. Talk a little bit about what colleges are required to do by law when a student reports a rape. Under Title IX, the 1972 law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, schools are required to address sexual assaults on their campuses. But what does that mean exactly?
Right. So both schools are required both to try to prevent sexual assault from happening and to address it and support survivors when they come forward. So there's some things, for example, like academic accommodations, housing accommodations, mental health resources that should be afforded to all survivors, regardless of if they choose to go through an adjudication procedure. So there those things are obviously to help students continue their education, which is what many students want to do. Additionally, schools have hearing procedures, and they're required by law to investigate sexual assaults that happen within their jurisdiction. And some students, if they choose to go forward with an investigation with their name, might go through something called a hearing procedure, which looks different at different institutions, but by law, survivors and alleged rapists are required to have the same rights, be treated the same way, and be given consistent information throughout the hearing process. And so what we've found, at not just UNC, but at schools across the country, is that not only are survivors not supported, so they're not being afforded academic accommodations, living accommodations, but when there were when investigations did take place, they were not fair, they were not equitable, And oftentimes survivors were discouraged from going to the police, from filing reports at the school, and just really weren't able to obtain that equal access to education, which is afforded to them under Title IX. So it's not just that... Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, so it's a misunderstanding that Title IX is just about sports or just about that one instance of sexual violence. It's actually about a student's entire educational experience. So if a student is assaulted and, for example, changes their major because their assailant is in the same classroom, or if they don't go running at night, or if they don't, you know, walk on some trail because it's known to be, you know, the rape trail or something like that, a student's entire education experience is impacted. And those are all different Title IX violations.
So just to be clear, I mean, what happens? Like, what are the steps victims are supposed to take after they are assaulted?
Yeah, I don't really think there is a supposed to take.
Well, right. I mean, a lot of people have no idea, right? So I assume that most students would maybe call either a counselor or call a cop on campus. I mean, what actually happens and who is supposed to step in?
Right. So most of the times, if a survivor does report, it's not immediately after the assault. Sometimes that does happen. They might go to a hospital, get a rape kit. And a lot of people ask, you know, why didn't you go to the police? We've got to remember we're talking about 18- and 19-year-old students who are away from home, some of them for the very first time, and they expect that their institution will protect them. So oftentimes the first person they tell might be a counselor, or if they're trying to, you know, drop a class, it might be an academic advisor. Or if, you know, their school actually has good procedures and it's clearly outlined and they were afforded that information at orientation, they might report it to a dean and choose to go through a procedure. So when that happens, when a school has actual notice or they're notified that something has taken place, they're required to do an investigation. And at that point, it should go to somebody known as the Title IX coordinator. And that person should tell the survivor about their rights, ask them if they want to go through a hearing procedure, and sort of walk them through that. Some schools have a victim advocate, which is a confidential person that a student could talk to if they don't want to report.
Does every school have a different procedure?
Procedures are outlined, and their best practices given in the Dear Colleague letter of April 2011, and then they were recently clarified by the Department of Education under the direction of the White House. Their FAQs, but it's not codified how schools should handle it exactly. So while the main themes of, you know, how schools handle cases throughout the country are very similar, the individual practices sometimes are left up to the school.
And that is Annie Clark. She's a women's rights and civil rights activist and blogger for the Huffington Post. When she was assaulted at the University of North Carolina, she says the school mishandled her case, so she and a friend filed a Title IX complaint against the school, and then dozens of women across the country followed their lead, and the story exploded. And now I would like to welcome Laura Dunn to the show. She's a nationally recognized campus sexual violence survivor and activist. When she was in law school, she successfully lobbied for the passage of the 2013 Violence Against Women Act and sat as an advisor to the White House Task Force Protecting Students Against Sexual Assault. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. So what would you add to what Annie said about what colleges are required by law to do to deal with sexual assault? Because I don't think a lot of people know what the law actually requires colleges to do.
Yeah, well, Title IX is obviously one law that is directing colleges on how to address sexual violence, but people often forget about the Clery Act. And in fact, the 2013 Violence Against Women Act reauthorization that I assisted in passing amended that Clery Act and actually expanded very specific rights for survivors on campus. So just like Title IX, students are allowed to have academic accommodations and living accommodations. So we've also expanded that requirement. If they work on campus, you don't just have to be a student to be protected against violence. You can actually be an employee who's working at the school. Additionally, survivors have the same rights as the accused to have an individual as an advisor present for the campus disciplinary hearing. The proposed rulemaking for that law just came out today. I was one of the student negotiators on it, and we've made it so that advisor of your choice literally means anyone you choose. If you want to have a mental health provider, you want to have an attorney, any single individual that you want as your advisor gets to be there through that process and be supportive to you. And schools can't limit that right. We also require there to be written decisions from these cases that provide reasons for what the finding was and also state what the sanction is given and why it was given. We often see colleges are not giving meaningful sanctions for sexual violence, sometimes just summer suspensions or even worse, essays or videos that they're sending students to watch if they've been found responsible for violence. So the Clery Act really adds to these rights and are more specific about what must happen during the course of an investigation, and for the first time ever requires campus officials to have annual training if they are going to be adjudicating these hearings.
And at what point do off-campus law enforcement, does off-campus law enforcement get involved?
Yeah, so under the Clery Act, there's actually a requirement when a school finds out from a victim that there's been a sexual assault, they're actually obligated to let the victim know, hey, you also have a right to go to the police. And not only that, but we're obligated to facilitate that process. So in my personal case, my university actually called the police station, set up a time for me, and they expected me. And if I had needed further assistance being transported there or anything else, they would have assisted me. And that's a requirement under law. So survivors have that right. They should be informed right away. And if they want to go through that criminal process, the school should be supportive of it.
Hmm. Laura, what would you say to people who think that this should be handled by off-campus law enforcement, that on-campus just doesn't have the resources to deal with this?
Yeah, I would say there's a reason we have two processes, a criminal and the civil rights one under Title IX. The criminal, obviously, is to the violent perpetrators off the street that are committing crimes. Unfortunately, not every state recognizes the spectrum of sexual violence. I know in the state of Wisconsin, when I was assaulted, alcohol was not considered an intoxicant. You could not be too drunk to consent to sex under the law of the state, and that was changed about the time that I was a senior. That wasn't the law when I was assaulted. We actually find that a lot with survivors who are from the LGBTQ community. Mm. The laws just simply do not protect them. And if the law doesn't protect you, or if there's just not enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that this occurred, that doesn't mean you should be left without a remedy. That's why we have the campus process. Students should be able to go to school, receive their education, without seeing the person that harmed them every day. And we have to remember Title IX isn't just addressing sexual violence. It's also sexual harassment, which isn't a crime necessarily. So we need this campus process to address more subtle forms of sex discrimination, harassment, and violence. And schools can handle it well. They have standards for preponderance of the evidence. They now are required to have annual training for adjudicators. They are very capable of addressing this. And in fact, when students commit other crimes, let's say a student is found selling drugs, they would not only face criminal penalties, but on their campus they may get expelled. Schools don't have to keep people who are committing harms as students.
Hmm. It's been amazing to watch this issue explode over the past few months and also just see the brave women and men. I mean, I've only really seen women in the media, but I know that men are also the victims of sexual assault. I'm guessing that it's really, really hard for them to come forward for obvious reasons, but we'll definitely talk about that. But I wanted to ask you, Annie, I mean, according to NPR's analysis, they just did some analysis recently, the number of people coming forward is just exploding. And you spent much of 2012 working to draft the Title IX complaint against the University of North Carolina. Can you talk to us a little bit about your story and what was it that made you say, okay, I've had enough, I'm going to go public with this now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't actually think the number of sexual assaults are getting higher. I just think people are speaking out more and we're connecting and are able to share information that way.
Right, but because that's what the NPR investigation pointed out, that more people are actually reporting it.
Absolutely. And in my individual case, so I was assaulted in 2007, and initially I didn't come public with it, you know, in the media or anything. I did talk to my university and was given a very victim-blaming response. At that point, I started working on UNC's individual policy and did that through graduation. A few years later, I was working at the University of Oregon, and I noticed the same problem. And that was when Andrea Pino, who was a survivor at UNC, used my policy that I created when I was a student she reached out to me. She said, it's still happening and nothing's really getting better. And so we sort of, you know, did some research and looked at schools all across the country and started noticing these similar patterns and trends of students being assaulted, their cases are mishandled, they don't know their rights, and then they kind of go away. And so what we set out to do was connect with other students, learn from those who had come before us, like Laura, and really connect in a meaningful way. And we started, you know, to call out schools publicly. I would say, you know, 2009, 2010, you know, Jane Doe is starting to get a face. And not only were we talking about our stories in an emotional way, we also had the law on our side. So we learned Title IX, we learned about the CLEAR Act, and taught other people to, you know, here are your rights, and you can do this too.
Talk about some of the ways that students or that campuses are mishandling these cases. What are you hearing from survivors? What's a common theme that comes up?
There's a lot of inequality in a hearing process. So a alleged perpetrator is told one thing, and the survivor, in some cases, is not allowed to see her own or his own documents. We're seeing a lot of underreporting. So under the CLEAR Act, schools are required by law to report certain crimes, including sexual assault, to the federal government. We're seeing schools with populations of 25,000 who report zero rape. We're seeing, also under the CLEAR Act, schools are required to do something called a timely warning. So when there is a sexual assault, when similar to, you know, if there was a shooter on campus, schools are required to notify students that that's happening. And we found that when the student, the alleged perpetrator is also a student, that wasn't happening. And those are violations up to $35,000 each, and that's under CLEAR. But also under Title IX, we just were seeing, you know, and still are seeing schools not accommodating survivors in ways that allow them to finish their education. So, you know, if the survivor, you know, reports, has PTSD, and then, you know, in the case of Berkeley and several others, students were having to go to individual professors and tell them their stories in order to get accommodations that should have been afforded to them, you know, and under Title IX and Title II. Yeah. So I think you have, you know, the underreporting problem, but then you also have students who aren't being given the resources they're required by law to receive in order to succeed.
Laura, what would you add to that about the mishandling of cases?
I think just generally there is a strong continued pattern of schools that are actively discouraging survivors in coming forward. I know in helping some clients here at Hopkins, there's this constant theme of no matter who you talk to, everyone's trying to deter you and say, well, this is a really traumatizing process. And, by the way, we've never expelled someone. So rather than go through this, why don't you just, you know, take care of yourself or take time off? And that really relates, you know, a lot to what Amy's been saying, that these survivors are given the runaround or they're just brushed under the rug. And we'd like to say that that's changed given all the complaints, but it still seems to be a norm. And one of the big concerning patterns is there is a lot of encouragement for survivors to report to the police, but now schools are saying, well, if the police are investigating, we can't do anything. And so schools are sitting for months not warning their campuses, not investigating, not giving accommodations while police are trying to handle the case. And unfortunately, police aren't always able to arrest someone within the first week of investigation. In Hopkins' case, there was a gang rape at a fraternity that took several months to investigate, and the school did nothing while it waited. So unfortunately, we keep seeing schools try to avoid the responsibility no matter what. And it's just really creating a hostile environment for survivors and also for other students who are learning what their school will do when there's sexual violence reported.
That is Laura Dunn. She's a campus sexual violence survivor and activist. When she was in law school, she lobbied for the passage of the 2013 Violence Against Women Act and sat as an advisor to the White House Task Force Protecting Students Against Sexual Assault. And we're also joined by Annie Clark. When she was assaulted at the University of North Carolina, she says the school mishandled her case. So she and a friend filed a Title IX complaint against the school. Dozens of women across the country followed their lead, and the story has since exploded. President Obama recently established a task force to study this issue. Nearly one in five women and one in 16 men is the victim of an attempted or completed rape while in college. This is according to a 2000 study commissioned by the National Institute of Justice. And if you have any questions about how colleges and universities handle sexual assault and rape, we'd love to hear from you. If this has happened to you and you'd like to share your story, you can remain anonymous if you'd like. But what happened when you reported it? Who did you go to and how did the school respond? How do you think schools should respond? What needs to change? And if you work in administration, we'd love to hear from you. We did reach out to Stanford. They did not. They turned down our request to join the show, but they did send us an email saying Stanford is not in a position to discuss individual cases, but in the disciplinary process for reported incidents, cases are heard by a panel of 3 students and 2 faculty or staff members, all of whom are trained in issues of sexual assault. The reviewers hear all of the information presented by the parties and then issue a finding and recommend what they believe to be the appropriate discipline. This is, we got this from Stanford University. They did not want to come on the show today, but they did email us a comment. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Susan Struble, who's Dartmouth College class of 1993, and she says all of the student activists are to be applauded for their work and thinking. Andrea and Annie have thought big, and they made it happen. They've brought incredible new hope and energy to the decades-long effort to ensure that every college student can pursue their education free from sexual violence and harassment. This is a public health issue. Alumni are essential in this national effort, as we have significant financial power, organizational influence, and institutional memory. We were students ourselves, and we remember. We're key to holding administrators and trustees accountable, and we're starting to be heard. Annie, can you talk a little bit about that? How are alumni getting involved in this?
Yeah, I think the alumni involvement is absolutely crucial. I mean, you talk about institutional memory. Students are there for 4, maybe 5 years, often less if they are a survivor and then not given resources. So I think alumni and that remembrance, not only monetarily, but also publicly calling out their schools, and not in a way that is because, you know, they're angry, just because they think, you know, their school should do better. If you have any sort of pride in your institution, you should want it to treat its students in a way that educates them and protects them, not silences them and, you know, shuts them down. And I do know that there are some alumni that have connected. They've had a few Google Hangouts. Elizabeth is a student, or was a student at Occidental College, has connected with folks at Dartmouth and Harvard and some other schools. And there is beginning to be a network similar to the survivor network that we have. We're also seeing a parents network sort of form. And I think that's also really crucial. Parents, not just of survivors, but of high school students who will one day be college students. So I think the voices of not just survivors, but people who care about their school, who hold positions of power, are absolutely crucial in making sure that their schools are held accountable.
And that is Annie Clark. When she was assaulted at the University of North Carolina, she says the school mishandled her case. So she and a friend filed a Title IX complaint against the school. Dozens of women across the country followed suit, and the story has since exploded. We are also joined by Laura Dunn, a campus sexual violence survivor and activist. When she was in law school, she successfully lobbied for the passage of the 2013 Violence Against Women Act. And today we are talking about how colleges and universities deal with and handle sexual assault on campus. So many colleges are under fire for mishandling these cases. So how are they doing it? What does the law say? And what do you think needs to change? It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to take part in today's conversation on Your Call on the phone, or by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can go to the yourcallradio.org website and simply leave a message. If you'd like to join us live on the air, the phone number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the escalation of sectarian violence in Iraq. How are the media connecting the violence in Iraq today to the 2003 U.S. invasion and occupation? American reporters are flocking to Baghdad. So what have they learned from 2003? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about rape and sexual violence on college campuses. Over the past few months, this issue has exploded in the media thanks to student and alumni activism. President Obama has established a task force to study this issue, and it's getting a lot of attention. Today, we are joined by Laura Dunn, a campus sexual violence survivor and activist, and Annie Clark. After the University of North Carolina mishandled her case, she and a friend filed a Title IX complaint against the school. Dozens of women across the country followed suit, and the story has exploded. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about how colleges handle sexual assault? What do you think about the laws on the books? What do you think needs to change? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work in administration, we'd love to hear from you. And if you are a victim of sexual assault on your college campus, what happened? Who did you report the crime to, and what happened after you reported it? We'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Alyssa in San Francisco. Hi, Alyssa. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your show and for bringing this topic, you know, up so often. I appreciate it. I survived a rape 3 years ago. It was a gang rape. And I went in San Francisco to two police stations and reported it. And they didn't even log it. And I was actually pursued after at my house. This person that harmed me, that drugged me and raped me and shared me with many people while I was unconscious. It was horrible. It was horrific. And I ended up going, they ended up taking me to a psych ward, to general, which is illegal. And I feel like that should be one of the laws that changes, that any rape victim, if they report this, they should go to the Rape and Trauma Center, never to a psych ward, because it's completely demeaning. And it's just not an appropriate environment for someone that's suffered trauma of that nature. I will be writing my story, and I will be hopefully emailing just because it needs to come out at this point. But I was shocked, personally, in the way that the medical industry failed me. They took me and mandated that I go to these, you know, support groups after at Kaiser. And they were for people that have come out of suicide, you know, or for people that were struggling with addiction. It was totally inappropriate to be in a group of co-ed, you know, survivors of other things and try to talk about this. I needed to be getting my police report documented and filed. I didn't need to be mandated to take this or threatened, you know, if I didn't take medicine, you know. Like, that's just, for me, that was really difficult. But it was shocking, too, to see that not one, there are domestic violence support groups now at Kaiser. There are a slew of support groups, such as restless leg syndrome, okay, but nothing that supports survivors of rape. So I feel like if there could be more continuity in the medical industry in A, reporting and documenting, and B, supporting through groups after, there would be, you know, more of a resolve in terms of the legal appropriation of this crime.
Wow. Alyssa, thank you so much for sharing your story. Did law enforcement eventually help you? I mean, what happened with that process?
It took four other people to come forward and accuse this one person. And it did end up going to trial finally, but I was not even brought in as a witness, probably because I was taken to general psych, and they just thought, hey, you know, don't call the crazy card or something.
Wow.
But all of this, every step along the way, was written, documented according to time and place and my statement and testimony. Mm-hmm. And it was all written very eloquently and coherently. And there's, you know, so that in itself, I feel like there are a few things that could be modified, but if the medical industry would just collectively say, hey, just as a doctor, if somebody reports this, if I see bruises, I can take a photo. I can get a blood test drawn for that specific drug, and I can get a rape kit done. Mm. My testimony as a doctor then will be viable in court.
Hmm. Wow.
Them going to a support group after, that would be helpful. I mean, I'd love to, like, get beyond all of this, but it does take, you know, a community, a village to raise a child, and I think this is a child we have to raise collectively.
Yeah, and, you know, thank you so much for calling. I'm so glad you brought this up, because we often look at these stories through numbers and statistics and a legal framework. And, I mean, so many of the articles I've read have not even at all touched on the healing process and what happens to these women and men after these crimes are committed. Annie, do you want to focus on this? Talk a little bit first about the medical issues Alyssa brought up, and then what are the healing mechanisms? I mean, again, 1 in 5 women, 1 in 16 men, and this is according to a study by the National Institute of Justice. There are victims of an attempted or completed rape while in college.
Yeah, definitely. And I just want to echo what you said. Alyssa, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's powerful, and I'm really sorry that the system failed you in so many different ways. But that's unfortunately not common. I think we do need to see more centralization, more streamlining, not only with the medical community, but with the police as well. There's actually, the Ashland Police Force is kind of has this prototype out where they have something called an options advisor within their police unit, within special victims, that basically walks somebody through every step of the way, whether that be getting mental health accommodations, reporting, going to trial, and I think that's been very successful. They've actually had higher rates of prosecution when they do that, when you see some consistency, when there is some streamlining. And I think that's something that could be replicated. And in terms of healing, there isn't just one way, and there's not the right way. It's not go to therapy or tell somebody. For everyone, it's different. Right. And for many college survivors, that often means taking time off, taking a lighter class load. You see some destructive behaviors. You see drinking and drugs and self-harming. You see suicide ideations, depression. Lots of survivors develop post-traumatic stress syndrome, which is something that really isn't talked about enough.
Hmm.
And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. Laura, what would you add to that?
Yeah, so I would just add, you know, I founded the organization Serve Justice, and now that I've graduated law school, we are offering legal services to survivors. Oftentimes, survivors think, I'll just report it and things will be handled fine, and unfortunately, whether you're going to the police or to the campus, we're seeing that that's not always the case, and survivors really need to have victims' rights attorneys with them through those processes, and there needs to be civil suits. There needs to be assertion of victims' rights in this criminal process, and we're hoping to expand actually to form a medical legal partnership in which we're considering the health needs of survivors, because it is crucial not just to gather forensics from immediate reporting, but also for long-term well-being of survivors to have holistic care integrated with reporting to survivors. And there are, you know, SART teams, sexual assault response teams, that try to mimic that. But it's really something that's lacking in our community. We are sometimes re-traumatizing survivors through our process rather than tailoring the process to both be healing and able to provide justice.
What would it take, Laura, to get something like this on college campuses? Have you been in touch with administration to talk about what is needed once, you know, the crime is reported, and then how victims can be helped through the healing process?
Yeah, so I just mentioned SART teams, sexual assault response teams. Campuses that do it best are working both with local police, local medical providers, often SANE nurses, sexual assault nurse examiners who are doing the forensics part, and also with campus officials and campus security. And when you really have a team, that way there's no kind of poor decision-making by any one actor, but holistic kind of considerations for what's best for the survivor. That's really what's making campuses handle it best, and also integrating that criminal and campus process, because there is such a disconnect. So the only thing preventing schools from doing that, quite frankly, is exercising that energy. It does take energy to reach out to the community and say, we want you involved in our process, and we want our process to complement yours. And hopefully over time, both with activist pressure, alumni pressure, survivors speaking out, schools will get over that hurdle and just reach out and say, we need to handle this better.
Well,
and I will, can I piggyback on this?
Sure.
Very quickly.
Please.
Yeah, I will say something that will be really helpful in the healing process is if schools streamline their resources. So, for example, most schools have a disability services office or an accessibility services office. They have counseling and wellness. They have academic counseling, but those resources aren't in touch with each other. So, for example, if you go to the counseling center and, you know, for PTSD, they should refer you to academic accommodation. And that should all be streamlined either within the Title IX office or with some support services on campus, so the survivor doesn't have to go to 10 different places, tell their story 10 different times, because that is re-victimizing. And what we've heard for students who have reported is that had they known how grueling and bad the process would be with their schools, they sometimes would have taken that decision back, which is really hurtful, and hopefully these resources and things can sort of change that so reporting can be beneficial and helpful in the healing process instead of re-victimizing.
All right. Well, thank you again, Alyssa. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about rape and sexual violence on college campuses. How are colleges dealing with this? How do you think they should? What are they required to do by law? What needs to change? If you work in administration, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have a story to share, we'd also love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Annie Clark filed a Title IX complaint against the University of North Carolina. She was assaulted and says the school mishandled her case. Dozens of women across the country followed suit, and the story has really since exploded. We're also joined by Laura Dunn, a campus sexual violence survivor and activist. The White House has featured her national nonprofit Survive Justice on its website. Survive Justice decreases the prevalence of sexual violence by assisting survivors, empowering activists, and supporting institutions. And we have an email from Holly who says colleges do a really good job of cracking down on plagiarism and academic issues that can affect their image with prospective students and certification boards. Perhaps if we make it more of an issue for their images, schools will make more of an attempt to address this issue. Annie, because this now is becoming such a major issue in the media and the White House is tackling this, have you seen many tangible changes from colleges across the country? And if so, where?
We've definitely seen a lot of scrambling. I think it's a little early to tell results, especially now with the summer. But if you go on a higher education job posting website, the number of people hiring victims advocates, Title IX coordinators, has since exploded. I mean, so they're definitely hiring more people. But in terms of reputation and image, that's actually what we found, too, in filing some complaints. It wasn't just the fact that we filed, but it's the fact that people have filed and have been talking about it publicly on Twitter, in the media. And that has really, gotten schools' attention. What I wish would happen is schools that haven't been under the public microscope, if they would start to make proactive. So this reactivity of my school's been called out in a national headline has been helpful for those schools. But I mean, what about where there isn't a spotlight?
Well, yeah. What would you add to that, Laura?
Just focusing on the caller's comment about plagiarism taken more seriously, we are seeing a big problem now that there is more enforcement in some areas as far as actually having judicial hearings and finding students responsible. We're actually not seeing the sanctions match that. There's just still this reticence from schools to actually give meaningful sanctions. The goal of every campus activist should be that my campus has expulsion as the default, and we shouldn't let up. And there are survivors right now. There's one at Brown who's specifically using her story to highlight the fact that meaningless consequences are being given even when schools are finding certain students responsible for sexual violence. So I'm hoping that not just with all these complaints that schools are thinking, oh, let's do more prevention, let's be more conscious, but let's actually not keep students from committing violence at our schools. And there's just been an unfortunate history where schools are afraid that they're going to be sued by the accused. Well, guess what? You can also be sued by the victim. You don't actually get to pick one side of this argument and always support it. And actually, the law, ironically, favors schools' decisions in disciplinary hearings when they do kick out students who have committed violence. Schools have broad authority to keep their campuses safe, And so every survivor and activist really needs to start focusing, what is on my campus? Are they expelling, or are they just doing a nice prevention program that makes everyone feel better?
All right. Well, thank you for emailing, Holly. Let's go next to Bob in Richmond. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. As usual, I think this is a really good show about a really difficult subject. I'm an attorney that actually represents people to have care homes for young children and or elderly people. And I'm very familiar with the Child Protective Services process and the Adult Protective Services process. Neither one is by many means perfect, but they do have an ability to pursue and come to a conclusion about allegations of, you know, abuse of one sort or another while the police investigation is ongoing. And I know what your guests were talking about in terms of an institution using, you know, the excuse that, well, we can't pursue this process because the police investigation is not done, and that often can take months. If, particularly if the school, excuse me, wants it to. So I just wanted to share that with them to say that if, you know, a college student is eligible to file an adult protective services claim, and that will bring a lot of attention to the victim and to the school. Hmm. And they might want to think of that. The other thing I wanted to add, and then I'll take the rest of this off the air, is that Title IX and any federal program that a school receives is governed by certain rules that if they believe are being violated, the federal government will withdraw all of its funds. And to do that, you can file what's called a whistleblower, they probably know this, complaint, which will bring an investigator to the campus. So if you have a college that you think is, you know, both receiving federal funds under Title IX or any federal funds, and you think they're abusing the process, you can actually get a free investigation from the government by filing a complaint and saying, we believe that this, you know, institution is misusing the funds. And that'll also bring some more heat to it, because I agree with what your guests are saying. I think it's pretty simple. If women were accused of holding men up by gunpoint and robbing them on college campuses, you wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, thank you for calling in, Bob. Annie, what are your thoughts on both of Bob's ideas? Do you think they're feasible?
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for the information and for calling in. I'm going to speak primarily to the second idea, because that's sort of what we have been doing, not under the Whistleblowers Act, but under Title IX and Cleary. We have filed those federal complaints, and we have gotten investigations out of them. Currently, there are over 60 schools that are under investigation for mishandling sexual assault, and their names are on the Department of Education's website. So that is one way that also the Department of Education does go and investigate, but also it highlights that scrutiny. The problem there is that there's kind of this death penalty or nothing approach. So the Office for Civil Rights, with whom these complaints are filed, can either revoke all federal funding from a school or basically do nothing. They could sit down with the school, and the school could promise to not, you know, do it again. They could fix their policies. But there really is no enforcement, and there really is no penalty there. So that's something else we're looking at, trying to give the Department of Education more enforcement power to enforce their own laws, basically. I don't know, Laura, if you want to add something there.
Laura?
Yeah, so Annie set it up perfectly. There are roundtables happening right now in the Senate that Senator McCaskill is leading. Serve Justice was at the first one. Know Your Nine was present at the second one. And there's actually going to be a third coming up about campus sexual violence being handled by the criminal justice system. But one of the constant themes is enforcement, enforcement, enforcement. We have filed several complaints. I believe now the number is like 61 schools that are actively being investigated. There are definitely more coming down the pipeline. But we're not seeing consequences, not just, you know, for perpetration on campuses, but actually the federal government, when they're reviewing, is not creating consequences. Tufts University was just found out of compliance with a voluntary resolution agreement. And that agreement is actually the first step that the government uses to gain compliance. So rather than there being a penalty, they just form an agreement that says, you know, you're going to hire a Title IX coordinator, you're going to change your policies, and we're not going to find you out of compliance. But don't you dare break this agreement, otherwise something will happen. Hmm. We just saw with Tufts, you can break it, and guess what they did? They just made another agreement. And Annie pointed right to the problem. They don't want to remove federal funding. That doesn't hurt schools. That hurts students. So we've been working very closely with Senator McCaskill's office trying to figure out, can we give interim penalties? The Clery Act has $35,000 fines. That's a drop in the bucket. We're trying to increase those fines. We're trying to create them also for Title IX. So I appreciate the caller's recommendation. And trust me, activists are looking at how can we get there to be a cost to this, because only when there is a cost do colleges decide to take this seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for calling, Bob. I also, Annie, you brought up the fact that a lot of colleges are not under the spotlight. So what about those schools, say the smaller schools, the community colleges, for example, or Bob Jones University? Al Jazeera America interviewed women from the early 1990s to the 2010s who were sexually assaulted, and none of them have fully recovered from what happened. And they say that at Bob Jones, a fundamentalist Christian college, they're basically told that their sins brought on the rapes, that their trauma meant they were fighting God, and that healing came from forgiving their rapists. So what do you do in a case like this, or a case like, you know, a school that is not getting any attention at all?
Yeah, first of all, those comments I think are absolutely detrimental to victims and healing. But yeah, with schools that aren't really getting attention, I think it unfortunately sometimes comes to the students, because administrators aren't really willing to call this out. I would, if there are administrators listening, I would encourage them to look at their own policies, even if they're not in the spotlight, and really ask them, you know, look at your mission statement of your school. Are you there to, protect your name, protect students? And really, if you want to protect your school, you sometimes have to call it out to make it better.
Laura, anything to add?
Yeah, so right now there's a big push on many fronts, whether you're listening to the roundtables or going to conferences on this topic. Everyone wants to see what's the best example of how to handle this. And so schools who are not in trouble, guess what? You have a race to the top set out before you. I know that organizations like the BTV Family Outreach Foundation have been developing this program called 32 NCSI, and they're actually trying to create an index to measure what schools are safe, what schools are handling this, not just in policy, but also in practice, because they want to highlight. And so schools can take this opportunity and say, well, we can be in one of two categories. We can be the school that's either getting in trouble through Title IX complaints, or like Bob Jones, through bad publicity, because survivors do exist at every campus. Or we can be at the top of the charts. We can have that START team. We can work with organizations in the community. We can have that linear process that gives survivors all the support they need. And we can make that part of our advertising. And I know my law school, the University of Maryland, has actually done that. They don't have a complaint right now, but they are going above and beyond and saying, we will set the bar. And so colleges have that opportunity. You want students to stay on your campus? Make your campus safe and advertise it.
And Annie, what are you hearing from men? 1 in 16 men is the victim of an attempted or completed rape while in college, according to the National Institute of Justice.
Yeah, we definitely do hear from men survivors. Typically, female pronouns are used just because those are the numbers statistically. But I think where we need to talk about men in addition to men as survivors is men as allies. Like, we know that most men aren't rapists, but most rapists are men. And those men who aren't doing anything wrong, instead of just, you know, standing there, what could they do to actively participate and not just ending, you know, a one-time awful situation, but day-to-day? I mean, you're thinking about your friends who are women and your classes, thinking everything from your language, like, that test rapes me. What does that say to a survivor in your class? And then I also wanted to point out something Laura touched on, is increasing the number of reporting rapes. So those Clery statistics where survivors report, a lot of schools are scared to have high numbers because that they think it means, you know, more sexual assault is occurring on their campuses, when in actuality a zero or a low number of reporting either means they are misrepresenting the reports, or survivors don't feel comfortable enough reporting there. Mm. So I think we really need to see a frame shift and having students or schools, you know, put out, you know, this is a safe campus, here are the things we are doing, here are our numbers, and yes, they're high, but they're high because
crime and, you know, violence happens everywhere, our students are just reporting it.
Right, because according to, again, an NPR analysis, the number of rapes that get reported increased 49% between 2008 and 2012. And Laura, what explains that? Is it because more people are speaking out?
I absolutely think that it is. Having worked with several campuses where there's like a named survivor who's in the media, who's fighting that fight, or even better yet, groups of survivors like we saw at North Carolina, they're encouraging so many people to come forward and say, you know what, there's no shame with this. I didn't cause this problem. Someone harmed me, and you know what, the school has to address this. And no apologies, no shame, give me my rights. And the more we see that, the more we're seeing reporting coming forward. And some campuses are very much embracing it. University of Michigan, who, you know, is under a Title IX investigation, has started to change its tone, and numbers are increasing. We're seeing reporting up in the 60s or 80s when it used to be single digit. So it really is because of survivors. And unfortunately, where campuses don't have outspoken survivors, we still have a lot of anonymous reporting or Jane Doe's or John Doe's coming forward. And we really need people to be brave and shout out the silence. There is no shame. And when you speak out, there's generations, student generations, who have been harmed that are willing to speak as long as someone takes that step forward and is courageous.
And Laura, for people who really, you know, care about this issue and want to get involved, a lot of alumni, again, are getting involved. What is the most effective action people can take?
I actually was just advising a professor at my law school about this. He was noticing on the list of schools under investigation that his alma mater wasn't there. And I said, well, I hope you write a letter. And you say, I'm glad you're not on this list. And I would love to know what else you're doing to support this issue. I know schools that are in trouble, like Harvard, who need to change their policies, they're having a lot of alumni combine with their undergraduate activists and really calling out and saying, we need to change. So depends. If you want to be proactive and assist your school, very much write them a letter of support saying, we're glad you're not under investigation. We hope this means that you also have these programs. What are you doing next? What are you doing to stay ahead of the curve and continue to have this good reputation of handling sexual violence? And there's a lot of power in that because alumni get donations. They have more power sometimes than students.
Laura Dunn is a campus sexual violence survivor and activist and founder of Serve Justice, which assists survivors. Annie Clark filed a Title IX complaint against the University of North Carolina, and dozens of women followed suit, and the story has since exploded. Laura and Annie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the escalation of sectarian violence in Iraq. How are the media connecting the violence in Iraq today to the 2003 U.S. invasion and occupation? American reporters are flocking to Baghdad, so what have they learned from 2003? We'll be joined by the Financial Times' Borzu Daragahi, McClatchy's Mark Seibel, and the Center for Investigative Reporting's Aaron Glantz. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.